Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we're wondering, what have the Romans ever done for us? In association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well then, last Saturday I saw another trip to Craven Cottage in the Premier League where we came away with nothing as we gifted Fulham 3 goals in a game where we never really got going. Perhaps minds were elsewhere then with our much anticipated Europa League game in Rome coming up this Thursday. Roma are scoring goals for fun under new boss Daniele De Rossi, and we will have to be a little bit better than we were on Saturday if we were to give ourselves any chance of reaching the quarterfinals. Now, obviously, all eyes are on Rome, but there is another game this Sunday with Nottingham Forest, our visitors to the Amex. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back a man who, in our opinion, is an unsung hero at the club. Having been a writer for Goalseye, he progressed to being the press officer with Dean, and he's now the head of media and communications. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Paul Camlin. It's lovely to see you, Paul. It's you've been doing this a while now.
Yeah, it has been a while. Thanks for having me back on again. Yes, been a while. Yeah, 26 years. If you 1998, I think I first started with the club. So yeah, it's been a journey, that's for sure.
I was about to say, people talk about the club's journey, and obviously there's it's a story, especially now that we're a European club side, and you know, obviously we'll come to that presently. And it's the J word is used quite a lot, but there's the trajectory itself is kind of a bit of a parallel of yours. Is you know, it's you started out as well, you know, trying to doing your best to try and get rid of the previous incumbents at the club. And here you are in the exalted position of media relations at a, like I say, European club. Can you give us a flavour of this journey that you've been on?
Well, I think everybody's been on it, haven't they? You know, certainly if you're old enough and you can remember the club playing at Gillingham and coming back to with Dean and then obviously the promotion to the Premier League. You know, that they're probably the key milestones along the way. And I've moved to the Amex, of course, coming before that promotion to the Premier League. So, yeah, it's been pretty incredible. Did I ever think we'd be in this position when we set out? I suppose you always dream, don't you? And you should. But realistically, I can remember when we got promoted to the Championship and, you know, you were looking at some of the grounds we were going to have the privilege to go and play, which obviously Brian played at in the past, don't get me wrong, but after that sort of start of the Premier League and the clubs that had been in the Premier League and dropped out, you know, you were going to stadiums or stadia that were very different to perhaps when we went in the past. So it was like a whole new world then. Then of course we kick on and we get our own stadium and then you end up in the Premier League. So, even that, I can remember Glenn Murray who'd been there with Bournemouth, been there with Crystal Palace, saying to me, it's a different world. You won't realise how big a thing the Premier League is until you get there. And it's astonishing. And, I mean, I read a statistic 2 days ago. We're the fourth most watched team in China, Premier League team at the moment.
Wow, really? How come?
You know,
incredible.
You just sort of see these stats. And don't get me wrong, they'll change. You know, they're cyclical. These things are cyclical. We're the most watched team in Japan for obvious reasons. You know, we were, start of the season, we were getting a lot of viewers watching us in Spain because of Ansu. Obviously, you had the injury and that would have tailed off. So these things are completely cyclical, but it's crazy to, yeah. I mean, I think it took me 2-3 years to get used to the fact we were on Match of the Day on a Saturday night. You know, it's been a phenomenal journey, yeah. And I think, you know, whatever comes, it kind of doesn't matter now. And hopefully it will continue, you know, and it'll continue the trajectory. But you feel like it's just been incredible and what we've achieved. And I think we will achieve more, don't get me wrong. But to come from where we've been and to reach the heights that we have, and we're starting to become an established Premier League team. You know, we say that very nervously and with our feet on the ground, but we kind of are. You know, it's funny when you talk to teenagers these days, and pretty much all they've known is Brighton as a Premier League team.
So we were saying the other day, Al, weren't we? That we were celebrating the fact that we're on 36 points now. That's normally enough to stay up. We're safe for another season.
That wasn't lost on me either. I'm not going to lie. and you know, there are teams that are not a million miles behind us in terms of their ambitions, and some that have been in front of us at times that would give their right arm to have 36 points at this stage in the season. Yes. So, we're in a good place.
Yeah, but Paul, I mean, you mentioned those other grounds, those other clubs that we used to go to. I mean, you know, kind of like a sliding doors kind of moment. You only have to look at the National League to see the clubs that are in there. And like on another day, if Robbie Reinhardt doesn't turn up and put that ball away, that could have been us. So the fact that where we are now, and that we're having this conversation, we're talking about going to Roma, it's just an incredible, incredible journey.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think I've always felt that even if we, you know, had lost at Hereford, dropped out of the league, I still think there would have been the desire and the sort of passion locally that wouldn't have been the end of the story. I don't think we would have gone out of business. Don't get me wrong, we'd have been on our knees, even worse than we were. But I still think there would have been a desire to bring the club back.
Mm.
Would we be where we are today? I don't know. It's very difficult to sort of second guess that. But I think there's been some incredible people involved at this football club, not least Tony Bloom, Dick Knight. You know, and very many other cast and crew as well along the way. Yep. Far too many to mention, but people who lived those years know.
We know. About. Yeah, we know.
And were integral to saving this club, bringing this club back to Brighton with Dean, and getting permission for that stadium. Mm. You know, that the fans' DNA is in the foundations of that stadium.
Yeah. Alan, we were just talking before the show. Yeah, we were just talking before the show about, you know, obviously the going to like Roma. How much would Ed Basford have loved that? I mean, how much would Sarah Watts have loved that? It is just, you know, these people are, you know, they're more than just footnotes in our history. They're so important.
No,
and Paul Welsh, footnotes. All of everybody.
They're not footnotes. They are building blocks
for sure. And you know, there are moments, I'm sure, where we all take those sort of little steps back and, you know, you pinch yourself moments. And for me, you know, just Marseille was one, Amsterdam was one, Athens was one. You know, just to those three trips, incredible. And now we're going to Rome, where, you know, as I think you said in your intro, won't be easy. Won't be easy at all. You know, we're talking about a team that more recently has played Champions League football, finalists in the Conference League last year, one of the top teams in Italy, you know, that we could be playing. Certainly buoyed as well by the change of manager. It's going to be a really tough night. And I think it'll stand us in good stead, those three games we've played in the group stages. I think that could be critical on Thursday night. Had we played, you know, no disrespect to the teams in the competition, but three lesser teams than those environments we went into, I think will stand us in really good stead for Thursday when we step out at the Olympic Stadium.
Sure. I mean, but if you're talking about sort of like, you know, the stage and the pinch me part of it, and let's face it, even when, and there's something else I wanted to talk about, like, even at the draw, if you'd have said, right, okay, Marseille, Ajax and Athens, you know, I think that, all right, we've turned them over and they're not necessarily teams on their best trajectory at the moment, but we've still, you know, faced and beaten what we put in front of them.
I wouldn't say we turned them over. I thought every game was tight, with the exception probably of the two Ajax games, where obviously Ajax were in a terrible moment for themselves. Yeah. But I think obviously both Athens games were tight, odd goal. And then obviously both we drew in Marseille and the game at the Amex. I thought we were dominant, and I thought we would win that game. And even right at the last moment, just before Joao scored, I still thought we were going to win that game. So it wouldn't say we turned teams over. I think, you know, the team showed incredible character to come through that group in the way that it did.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when you think we lost the first game and we're 2-0 down away in the second game and everybody's writing us off.
But there was that moment in Marseille. It happened just before half-time. And I don't know what happened. Just something changed and something clicked and we just showed, oh, hang on a minute. We can get something
here. Had the chance just before half-time.
Yeah.
I think Ansu had a chance as well, didn't he, just before half-time?
Yeah, you know, there were a couple of good chances. I don't know. It's funny. We that Aston Villa game, I look back at the start of the season and it was never a 6-1 game, but Villa was that worthy winners on the day. But you kind of look back at it, and even at, I think we were 3-0 down at half time.
Something like that.
And then scored, and you actually believe. Saturday, we're losing 2-0 at Fulham with 10 minutes to go. And I did turn to Steve Gibbon at that point. We were sat in the stand together. I said, do you know what? The most crazy thing, as poor as we've been today, this team still believe they can win this game of football. 2-0 down with 10 minutes to go. So you know, there's an incredible amount of character in that dressing room. There's an incredible amount of belief in that dressing room that they can win games of football. You know, and look, Saturday wasn't our best game. Let's not beat around the bush.
No.
I don't think we were terrible. But we just
71% of possession.
Absolutely. But, you know, we've been there before with in recent years.
Everyone.
So, you know, it's about scoring goals, don't get me wrong. But you can still see that belief at 2-0. And I think it's been phenomenal. The reaction of our fans has been unbelievable. When the Luton fans were singing at our fans, why are you still here? You know, in slightly more industrial language. But I thought that was an incredible moment. And, you know, and even as tough a night as that was, I thought it was incredible from the fans. And I think that's a token and appreciation that this group of fans, just one of them, have got for this team and this squad of players.
I would like to caveat that with the fact that there was a train strike and they couldn't go home.
Well, if you had your car on the street and you could, I'd be honest with you, I thought that was incredible. I've been there to see Brighton. Very, very rarely leave a game early, even when I was a fan. Palace 5-0 was the exception. Tried to leave that early. So, yeah, you know, I think people will try and leave early. But the fact that they stayed with the team, I thought was incredible that day. We've seen it at the Amex when we're 2 or 3 nil up and the away end cleared out. We saw it not so long ago with at the Palace. Oh, yes. So, you know, so I think that's, don't underestimate that. And I think there's a lot of, you know, feeling for this team and in, that for me was like, we're still with you guys, even though this is one of the tough nights of the season, we're still there. A lot of other clubs wouldn't do that. The only place where I've been in the last few years where I would say that's really evident, I think the Nottingham Forest fans have been incredible every time we've gone there.
They make one hell of a racket, don't they?
Yeah, and I can remember when we were, I think, leading 3-1 Forest
this season. Before
Lewis got sent off, yeah. And there were, you know, a lot of other grounds people would have started to leave with 20 minutes to go.
Yeah.
And obviously, the sending off changed the dynamic of the game, and they came strong and got that goal back. And it was an opportunity for them to try and get a point. But nobody left at 3-1 when effectively, you know, we felt that was game over at that point, given Forest position in the league, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you would see that at other grounds. So, yeah, I think the Forest fans have been exceptional. Others will talk about other teams and, you know, but when you look at those teams and they've been in the same position as Nottingham Forest, I don't think their fans have been as unwavering in their support of the team as the Forest fans have been. So I've got a lot of respect for their supporters, got to say.
I think that probably what we've got at the moment is that a lot of, I'd liken it to sort of the people understanding the difference between weather and climate. They can see and understand that at the moment, these last two seasons, certainly the best ever times in our 120 plus year history. And of course, you know, then
without question.
Yeah, without question, you know, we've never been, even when Graham Potter finished his final full season, there was a certain optimism. There was a certain zeitgeist in his first half dozen goes before he disappeared to Chelsea. Again, we started really well, and obviously then Roberto came in, you know, sort of took a little bit of time to get his ideas in, and then you saw us motoring again. And the way that, I think that probably the really exciting bit is the fact that we've turned over, and I'm going to use that phrase, and properly turned over the likes of Manchester United and Liverpool and Arsenal. We've played them, not just played them, but absolutely beaten them beautifully. Now, it hasn't happened to quite the extent this season, and we're back to AD's phrase earlier of managing expectations, but obviously there are caveats to that, like trying to put out your first ideal first 11. But even then, with the sort of like the relative certain lack of excitement compared to the newness of turning over Manchester United and Liverpool and Arsenal on a nauseous basis, we realise that we are in this elevated position. We have sustained ourselves for the last 2 years as a top 10 club, which is something that Tony has talked about. Hopefully we can continue it. And if we're on the path that we're on, then there's, I'll say no reason, there's probably several reasons why not. But, you know, just the nature of Roberto De Zerbi's style means that once in a while, in amongst all this beautiful weather, it's going to chuck it down. And that's just the contract we've signed up to.
By the way, I think that's the same for any Premier League team. Look at Liverpool last season and some of the difficulties and the results they had. And they stayed together as a club, and look at them this season. And I actually, the last few weeks, I've really enjoyed watching Liverpool and their young players. I think they're a really excited team. I think they've got some really exciting young players who are going to be big, big stars. Obviously, they all won't. It's just the nature of the beast. Well, they may be. I think the only time we've ever seen that is the class of 92 with Manchester United. Those six players that came through in that 1 year or around about that 1 year. You know, so I don't know whether Liverpool will achieve the same, but I think there's some really exciting players there to watch. But not so long ago, you would have had, you know, Liverpool having to sort of drop down into the Europa League, almost being seen as disaster. A barren year last year, et cetera, finishing one place above ourselves, you know, and at times they were chasing us. So I think every club has that. Maybe with the exception of Manchester City, who obviously have if not the best, certainly one of the best coaches in the world, some of the best players in the world, and arguably the best team in the world. You know, and they've built up to that, and they're an incredible football team.
Yeah.
You know, bar City, I think every team suffers that. Arsenal last year, blimey, they got beat 3-0 at home by Brighton. And their
Stop. I love the way you say that.
Everybody has those rainy days. Nobody's got a God-given right to turn up and win a game of football. And there are no easy games in the Premier League. It's cliche, but it's true. You know, we struggled to beat Sheffield United and Burnley in the home games. You know, we lost at Luton. They're the three teams in the bottom three. On paper, we should beat them. But it doesn't work like that. And that's why our league is the best league in the world. Because even the teams that are down the bottom are struggling on their day. You know, Luton have been a phenomenal watch this season.
Incredible.
You know, and actually, there's been some snobbery around Luton. And a few people in the media have said it to me at the start of the season. And, you know, it shouldn't be allowed in and blah, blah, blah. Nonsense. The ground is as welcoming and as, you know, in terms of coming and playing a game of football, it's a pitch. It's a football pitch. Okay, it's not the most salubrious surroundings, but it does what it needs to do. Luton have invested incredibly in the broadcast and media facilities to bring it up to Premier League standard. And I take my hat off to them. And I think in Rob Edwards, they got a brilliant young manager who's done a brilliant job there. And I don't know if they will stay up, but if they do, fair play. They've made a real fight of it this season. And at times, they've been brilliant to watch, really exciting. Okay, they're not the prettiest. They're not going to play. They play to their strengths, but there's been some wonderful performances, certainly the two in midfield. I really like Ross Barkley. I always thought he was top for England, and I felt his career was disappointing when his career went off track. And Lokonga as well in the middle for them. And then obviously the players they've got up front are a real handful. And yeah, it's they've made a real fight of it, and it's been interesting watching them this season.
Yeah. I mean, again, with Luton, there's the story there. The fact that they've had to come back up from non-league to get to where they are. And not
think one our own story.
Exactly. And, you know, absolutely no team has any divine right to any sort of success. And to see the progress they've made this season, and we were very, very lucky to have the first game of the season when they were perhaps a little bit naive in that game, I think. Yeah. Because, I mean,
I still thought I came away with that game from. And I can remember saying it. Someone said it to me the other day, but I said it to one of our coaching staff. I've got a feeling they'll stay up. Out of the three, I think they've got the best chance of staying up because of the spirit, the togetherness. That's what carried us the first 2 years. You ask Dale Stevens, Glenn Murray, Bruno, those sort of players that played those first couple of years, what carried us through? Dunkey will tell you, was that incredible spirit where you come up together. And I think that carried us through those first 2 years. Brentford, it would be the same. You know, it's so important that. And I think Luton have got that in real abundance. And do you know what? That night, when you saw the way that the crowd and the club came together for their captain as he walked around the pitch before, I can remember thinking to myself at that point, this could be tough tonight. They're so up for getting a result here tonight. Fans, club, players, this is going to be a tough game tonight. And it was.
Look, we could have helped ourselves a bit, but yes, I mean, when you've got this kind of this speeding bulldozer coming at you, it's usually pretty hard to get out of the way. It's single swim, and, you know, and if you're not up for it, you're not going to be up for it. But I just want to take you back to
that. Mal said to me after that game, he was doing co-commentary, and he obviously played for both clubs. He said it didn't matter who Lou played that night. They were winning that game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they played Man City, maybe that they would not. But if they played Arsenal, maybe. But you could sense they were so up for that game. And it's an interesting comment. Not making excuses. Look, you're going to win games, you're going to lose games. Unless you're Arsenal in 2004, it's the invincible season, everybody loses games.
Well, you only have to look at the fight they put up against Arsenal when, you know, that Arsenal needed a last-minute goal to win 4-3. And
they all struggled. All the big clubs struggled there. Chelsea, Arsenal. I mean, Chelsea was 3-0 up, 3-2, you know, and clinging on at the end. Liverpool obviously only drew there. So Tottenham early in the season, even. I think they only won by one goal. So nobody's had it easy there. In fact, if you look at it, really, Luton haven't got apart. you know, maybe that game against us at the start of the season, nobody's really hammered Luton. Even City in the Cup the other night, there was a moment where you thought Luton were going to do this. You know, Saturday evening, you know, it's incredible.
You see, we're not the only team that can look good conceding six. So, but okay, well, what I wanted to talk to you about, Paul, because obviously you've been doing your job for quite a while now, and I just wanted to really talk to you about how that job has changed. Because when you started, the internet was really in its infancy, and the way things have progressed now, where everyone's got an opinion, there's keyboard warriors absolutely everywhere. And again, it's about, I mean, I think one of the hats you have to wear is as a firefighter quite a lot of the time, because putting to bed all these internet rumours and stuff. So, I mean, how is
that? To be honest, on that one, we don't tend to comment. We let them just sort of hang out there. Occasionally, somebody will ring you and you will sort of say, nah. I mean, usually when someone throws a name at me and it's nonsense, you usually say to the journalist, do you think that's sort of player we'd go for? Oh, no, he doesn't really fit the Brighton profile, does he? You've answered your own question. You know, there's a little bit of that sometimes. But typically, we wouldn't comment on you know, what you call firefighting. You know, sometimes in January, you end up just ignoring people. I had a great story about a journalist the other day who said to a Premier League manager, I've texted you a few times. I think you must have changed your number. And the Premier League manager said, no, I haven't. I'm still at the same number. No, it's all well. He read his text and was blatantly ignoring him because he didn't want to comment. So, yeah, it's all that side of it actually is just, and I think people have said it before, most of the rumours you read, you know, that we'll be linked with 25 players during a transfer window. We're not going to sign 25 players. So it's nonsense.
Does that sort of aspect of it drive you up the wall, though?
Yeah, well, not really. It just there's this sort of insatiable appetite, and I think journalism's evolved massively. So, you know, back in the day, there'd always be stuff around transfers, but it wasn't this sort of. And I think Sky Sports News and the whole transfer deadline day thing and what have you fueled it. I've always said until, you know, and I say this to journalists a lot, they say, oh, we know so-and-so's at the training ground for a medical, or so-and-so's flying into the country this afternoon, and blah, blah, blah. The answer's always the same. Until that piece of paper's signed, sent, sealed, and delivered, there's nothing to report in our eyes as a club. So, you know, and it's funny, really. People sort of know that a transfer is about to happen, but it's true. You know, you never know. We've had transfers that we've been so close to doing, and then they've fallen through for whatever reason. It might be that somebody doesn't pass a medical, whatever that reason might be. So we'd never comment until it's done. There's nothing to say.
And this is
go on, Al. I was going to say, it's funny. Go on.
I'm not expecting necessarily a comment on this, Paul, but maybe if I can see a sort of a jumping pair of eyebrows, is the amount of comment there was at the time of the sale of Moises Caicedo, and just about everyone seemed to know what it was that the Albion wanted for him, or were prepared to accept for him. And you're thinking, unless you actually live inside Paul Cameron's or Paul Barber's or Tony Bloom's head,
well, I don't
how
know.
Blazing
I,
can they know?
No. Tony wouldn't even tell me, and I wouldn't be comfortable even asking him. Whether he tells Paul Barber, I don't know. That's between Paul and Tony. You know, that's private. Yeah. Whether he tells David Weir, that's private. But no, Tony would never divulge a number. So anything that you read that says, so Brighton want X for this player is nonsense.
Just gibberish, yeah.
Absolute nonsense, because, you know, why would you? Because you're not doing yourself any favours whatsoever. I mean, the Moises one, obviously, we wanted to keep him as a club.
Long, definitely.
We didn't need to sell him. We didn't want to sell him. You know, Roberto felt that he could have had a massive impact on our season. He's obviously alluded to that since. But, yeah, it was... It, I thought there was a good chance we'd keep him through much of the window, but we tried. But that's the nature of football. There's always going to be... And by the way, this sort of selling club thing annoys me. Every club's a selling club and every club's a buying club. I think we're lucky enough that, you know, we're probably in a position now where we don't need to or don't want to sell our top players. I think we're in a position where, you know, because of the incredible work that's gone on for the last 3 or 4 years, you know, we are in a fortunate position, and I think we've got a terrific squad. You know, it'd be interesting to see what the summer brings. You know, we're not a selling club. We've got some terrifically talented players, and we want, the aim is to keep getting better on the pitch. It's not, we don't want to keep, you know, nobody wanted to lose Marco Correa when he went. The idea was that he'd be here longer than a season. Nobody wanted to lose Moises when he went. The idea was that it'd be longer than 2 seasons, you know. So, but it's the nature of football. Someone comes in and does exceptionally well, you're going to have interest in that person.
Yeah, we're just wondering how much we're going to get from the next chief scout, actually. I mean, that's...
Actually, please tell me Chelsea haven't approached you. Don't answer that. But I mean,
Alan, you know what the answer would be to that, even if they did. But no,
does it end at all?
Yeah, not.
Even if it was a figure that Tony accepted,
well, that'd be up to Tony. But I don't think that it would be a. Yeah, I don't think we'd be talking about a transfer fee. They'd probably be paying Chelsea to get to take me.
But this is
the other way around now.
But this is actually sort of part of the narrative, and. You saying what you're saying, and it kind of pretty much confirms what we suspect. Obviously, we can't know because we're not part of the club. But there is a narrative that goes across the press and goes across the media as to how well Brighton is run. And yet the main criteria they seem to use for that, and I think it's desperately unfair on everyone else, is that we buy cheap and sell high. And I'm thinking, well, there's clearly far more to running a club well than just the transfer fees, you know, or taking a player who didn't cost much and turning them into a gem. I mean, how does that narrative play out across the club?
I mean, that's a nonsense as well, because I can remember someone, you know, Jack Inchwood had played about 10 games, and someone, a fan, saying to me, that's basically saves us 30, 40 million. And they're right, because that's not buying cheap. That's a good player that's been with us since he was 8 years old.
Yeah, nurtured.
Developed by the academy. You know, more recently, obviously, been working with Roberto, and Roberto's sort of brought him on even further this season. And, you know, you see the advancement that he's made in the short space of time. He's just been with the first team. It's been incredible. And he's hardly played in his position. You know, we've been playing him out of position most of the season. So I think it's all of these things. I think it's I don't want to sort of sound, sort of wacky in the language, but it's a sort of, it's that sort of 360-degree approach. You're looking at everything. And I think credit where credit's due, that was one of the things that Ashworth came in and did. And put in place and improved what we were already doing. You know, Tony made that incredible investment into the facility at Lancing, further expanded it as well. But then also that place now operates and lives and breathes. So you're developing through the academies, boys and girls academies. You're looking to recruit the best players you possibly can to fit our ethos and how we want to play.
Yeah.
And I think also, if you're a young player or a young player's agent and you get the opportunity to come and play at Brighton, you know you're going to get chance. You know you're probably going to progress. And I think pretty much most of the young players that have come have done that. Even the ones that perhaps haven't seen the first team, you know, I think every single young player that's come in that we've brought in that way, even the ones that went on loan, didn't play for the first team, they've all made steady progress.
Yeah.
So I think it's there's so many people involved in that process. You can't just say, you know, it's one scout or it's one head of recruitment or it's one technical director. It's a team effort. And when one of the team goes, and I don't mean the football team, I'm talking about the team off the pitch,
yeah.
You know, and that's when you hear Paul Barber speaking about succession planning and knowing who could step up next, being confident enough to back your own staff to step up as well. You know, how many businesses don't give people that opportunity? And
yeah.
And the guy that's worked with that person for 5 or 6 years, learned all their good traits and maybe not learned their bad traits and got some of their own good traits.
Mm.
Yeah. And then steps up and does the job either equally as well or even better in some cases.
Yeah.
So I think it's having the confidence to back your own staff in that respect. Knowing what needs to be done, sticking true to your principles as well. That's really important. Your principles and your values and sticking true to them. And I think people do at the football club.
Yeah, I mean, it is important. I mean, it's not just on the grass that we're seeing this pathway. We're seeing it, like I said, with the succession planning. It's a massive fillip for the players who were playing with Adam or have been playing with Benicio Baker Botti, seeing them coming into the first team and excelling and, you know, and seeing Jack scoring goals even. And, you know, that's it.
Don't underestimate as well the effect that the likes of Adam Lallana, Danny Welbeck, James Milner, Jason Steele, those senior players, Lewis Dunk, Adam Webster, even Sonny March, those senior players in the group have on those young players. I mean, Adam Lallana, I would say, more than anybody is responsible for us having that belief that we can go toe-to-toe with teams in the top six. Because I can remember him being so peed off when he walked through the door and it was almost like, oh, it's Liverpool today, it's a free hit. If we get anything, it's a bonus. That used to drive Adam mad.
Really?
To tell you, he used to hate it. And I wouldn't say single-handedly, but almost single-handedly has changed that mentality within the football club. Giving the players, and that's rubbed off on the fans as well, don't get me wrong, the belief that we can go to Old Trafford and win, that we can go to Anfield and win, that we can go to Arsenal and win, Tottenham and win. You know, we never believed we that was like, oh, if we get something here, if we nick a draw, wouldn't that be amazing? You know, I can remember being absolutely crushed when we lost 1-0 at Tottenham to a very late goal under Chris, I think, in that first or second
season. Yeah, Christian Eriksen really late, I remember it.
You know, and but at the time, you're like, we're going to get a point at Tottenham. You know, whereas now,
they score in the 96th minute.
Going to win.
And
so much of that comes from Adam Lallana, because that I can remember that first season he would be so peed off if anybody sort of had that mentality going into one of those games. You know, he saw every game as an opportunity for 3 points, and I think he's breathed that through the football club and helped change that massively.
To the point that everyone else now has that mindset. I mean, like what I mean is,
yes,
if you took Adam out of the equation, would there be other people who would be just as cheese boy?
I think that's his legacy. If and when he decides he's not going to play anymore, and I think there's a fair chance he'll end up doing some coaching, you know, when that might be, I think he's changed that mindset within the four walls of the dressing room without question, more than anybody. More than anybody.
Incredible. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, we're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us another lovely shirt to have a look at. Have you got it there, Paul?
Yeah.
Any ideas? Would you want to describe it first?
Well, it's very orange. Sort of like our crimson colour is the main colour.
Yeah.
Navy shoulders that sort of come down, look like they're going to come down in a V, but they've got a sort of square patch with the badging.
Yingli Solar is the sponsor, and there appears to be a sponsor on the sleeve, as well as perhaps a lead patch on the other sleeve, made by Diadora, which maybe makes me think it might be an Italian team.
The odd thing is that I thought it might be Italian on account of the fact that I believe, I have no hard and fast proof here, but I believe I recognise the badge.
I recognise the badge, and I was going to say something, but...
Go on.
Is it Genoa?
Genoa, that's exactly who I was going to say.
I'll give you a clue. It's not Italian.
Oh, okay. You and I had the same thought then, Paul. I thought it was Genoa, yeah. or Sampdoria, same thing, but...
Genoa. All right.
It is European. I will give you that.
I mean, in that case, we could go all around the continent, mate. And if the fact that it's not Genoa has actually thrown me, so...
Okay. Well, would you want to put a year on it?
I'm just Googling Genoa's crest because I'm sure that is very...
Well, I think it's actually one of those... Sampdoria and Genoa being in the same city. I've got a feeling they wear the same colours. I could be wrong, but... the only other thing, red and blue halves, is that a clue in any way that throw us a bone here, AD, while looking it up.
I'll give you a clue. There are actually some decent links to the Albion one. So.
In that case, is it one of the Austrian sides, like red?
No, it's Spanish. I will put you out of your misery. I'll tell you all about what Phil has given us this week. He said, here is your shirt of the week. And it is the 2009 to 2010 home shirt of Spanish La Liga side Atletico Osasuna. They go by the nickname of Los Rojillos or Godic's Oak, both which translate roughly to be the Little Reds. I've no idea how you pronounce Godic's Oak, neither do I, but I'm having a go. Home is the 23,516 capacity El Sadar Stadium in the Pamplona region in the city of Pamplona in the Navarra region of northern Spain, which borders the Basque and Rioja regions to either side. The side was formed in 1920, and to date, they are the only side from Navarra to play at the top level of Spanish football. The club is owned by its members and is one of four clubs in Spain to have that ownership model, the others being Real Madrid, Athletic Bilbao, and Barcelona. Los Rojillos played 42 seasons in the top flight in Spain, not consecutive to be, and they first qualified for European football in 1986 after finishing sixth in the league. They played in the UEFA Cup the following season, beating Rangers in the first round, but were knocked out by Waregem from Belgium in the second round. They've made sporadic appearances over the years in European football and were due to play in this season's Europa Conference League. However, after investigations into match fixing between 2012 and 2014, UEFA found them guilty and subsequently banned them from this season's competitions. Some notable former players with links to the UK then include John Aloisi, who played for Portsmouth and Coventry between 1997 and 2001 before he moved to Osasuna, where he played for 5 years, making more than 130 appearances. Sammy Lee pretty much finished his professional career with Osasuna in 1990, and Ashley Grimes had an injury hit spell with them between 89 and 91. Of course, there's some Albion links. Do you want to name them?
Michael Robinson.
Purvis.
And Purvis, absolutely, yes. The Seagulls legend that is Michael Robinson's played three seasons for us in Division 1, making over 120 appearances and scoring 37 goals. He eventually made his way to Spain and Osasuna in 87, where he played the last 2 years of his career before retirement. And as Paul has said, Purvis Estupiñán spent a season on loan from Watford at Osasuna in 2019.
I think for one more, AD, I think.
The one?
Olandi.
Jagua.
Who, sorry?
Amiki Ifeazuagua.
Blimey. That is true.
Remember him scoring at Barnet away in about 1999?
That's a name that had completely gone out of my mind, but I do remember the goal.
I'm pretty sure. I'm just Googling it now. Yeah. He left Charlton for Osasuna the end of that season. He came on loan for us. He played two games.
Yeah.
You've been a certain lady.
Under Brian Altman.
That is, I can't believe it. I've been outstated, blimey.
But there you go.
But obviously, I mean, we've seen some great players come through here. But I mean, I don't think, I mean, how do you feel, Paul, when you're seeing, like, particularly during the transfer windows, where people are tracking planes from, oh, this one's coming in, it's going to land here. I mean, that wasn't happening with Alexis Bertrand, was it?
No, but yeah, I guess, no, it's just excitement, isn't it? And it's a whole industry within the industry. And going back to your earlier question about how it's changed, it's incredible, really. You know, back in when I first started at the club, in terms of if we sent a press release out, we used to do it by fax. And I kid you not, there was a button on the fax machine that would splurge the fax out to, you know, Southern Sound, the Argus, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how you'd announce a signing and confirm it. And, you know, you might put a call into the likes of Andy Naylor, or back then it would have been John Leeds at BBC Sussex. And, you know, that would have been the sum of all parts for the media. No website, no social media. You had a match day program. You had things like the Seagull Line, or you'd do an interview with BBC Sussex to get your messages out there. Now you've got this direct connection to the fans, this insatiable appetite for news, content, information, entertainment. You know, it's not just about press releases. You know, you've got to entertain. We're effectively media operations, you know, media houses, publishing houses, whatever you want to call it. And we have to you have to deliver that on a daily basis. People want that content. They want to know what's going on, and, you know, what might be happening, and, you know, who's fit to the weekend, and blah, blah, blah. I guess the content doesn't really change. It's just the volume of it.
No.
The sheer volume of it that would, and it's funny, really. I talk about the social media stuff, and
yeah,
if you think back 20 years ago, they were conversations in pubs. Mm. We'd be sat in the pub.
Yeah.
You know, the three of us might be sat in the pub tonight talking about the game on Thursday. Those sort of conversations are now probably taking place in chat rooms, on social media.
No, they're still happening in the pub.
No, I was about to say, we are still analog
absolutely.
Fans.
Absolutely, they are still happening in the pub.
Yeah.
But for the younger generation, you know, we're the older generation. That's how they're happening. And they're still happening on traditional media, you know, the radio, the newspaper. That's still got a part to play. So,
absolutely.
But there's just this
it's that analog aspect that actually probably helps keep the club going, isn't it? Because one of the things, well, certainly me and AD and probably thousands of others do, is we get to the ground, you know, you might be watching the lunchtime kickoff, but you'll have a pint, you discuss the game, you watch the game. Then afterwards, thanks to the sort of like the train's not being able to cope with everyone at the same time, you stick around for a couple of beers, you look at the highlights, you have your post-mortem, you get it out of your system. And like I say, there are some, and I do it. We do it just because of our show. Well, we'll tweet a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the game or whatever. But apart from that, it's the conversation in the pub. I'm going to assume that it's not unique to Brighton. But one part of it that is because we stick around at the ground and within the confines of our very own cathedral can actually stop and talk about football in the way that we do in the most appropriate setting, i.e. in a football stadium, which then, you know, sort of by the next progression helps the club because we're spending so much money on beer, says to me that, yes, there is that digital element, but, the, you know, us old school, old farts that parks ourselves up in the West Stand Upper, or once upon a time in the North Stand in the Goldstone, are still, to me, such a key lifeline in this club.
Yeah, I think the club will never lose sight of that. All the time that Tony's at the helm, no question of that whatsoever. Tony knows what the fans mean to this club and what the club means to the fans. There's that will never change while all the time that Tony's chair and owner of the club. So you've got no worries on that score. One of the first things he said to me when he came in was, you know, and in my role, looking after the media, make sure you look after the guys that have been, you know, that have been on the journeys to Hartlepool away on a Tuesday in the middle of October, or up and down the country every Saturday afternoon, Tuesday night, when we were bottom of the league and struggling for our very existence. So you'll never, the chairman will never lose sight of that. And I think that's, I wouldn't say it's completely rare, but it's difficult to do that sometimes in the sort of Premier League. This razzmatazz, and we've got this huge fan base now across the world where people support Brighton and Albion. But we're just doing a bit of work at the moment about our sort of media comm strategy going forward, and we're looking very global. But separate to that, we're looking at local, because it's vitally important that we remember that our roots and though the fans, the media, whatever it is on the local level, those people are very much part of the DNA of this football club, and that's also what underpins our values as a football club. We pride ourselves on that and doing things in the right way. And yeah, sometimes you do get it wrong. Don't get me wrong. Nobody's perfect. But I think you've got that mentality, and every day you come to work, there is a desire to do things in the Brighton and Hope Albion way.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we were coming back from Amsterdam, and I went and stayed with our friends from the Dutch Seagulls, and we got off the train in obviously in Kent, and we're driving down the motorway, and Werner says, "Oh, look, we can go to Gillingham. Shall we go to Gillingham?" I'm going, "I'm never going back there ever again." But it was just casually dropping in. Oh, just coming back from Amsterdam. It's insane, isn't it? I mean, it's funny, but just to go back onto a point you made earlier there, Paul, you were talking about the fact that the information prior to the internet existing was all in the programs and stuff, it's a mess.
Oh, by the way, and prior to Dick being there, nobody at the club used those means at all. So even though you had those very limited resources, the clowns that were running the club at the time didn't even use them other than to slag off the fans, if you
will. But I mean, quite often on this show when we're chatting to some old player from yesteryear or whatever, and who played for us before the internet existed, and that's why Ian Hines Seagulls programs website is such an important facility, because he's all the programs from the 30s to present day are on there, and you can go in there and you can find out who was playing the Brighton centre when Steve Penny made his debut, or it's either that or Tim Carter's book. I mean, these are absolutely brilliant sources of information for any Albion fan.
If you go back
I mean, all of that stuff. And I mean, it's crazy, isn't it, how the programme evolves over the years. And we still do all right with the programme. Our sales stand up okay, but some clubs don't even produce a programme in the AFL. And I understand, I understand that. It's difficult if your programme's not making money and your team, you haven't got that crowd that'll come in and buy it. But Brighton fans have always been good at buying and reading the programme. And I think, that's one of the things I would say, since certainly all the time I've been at the club, we've always had a decent programme. Luke does it now, I think, does an exceptional job. I think the Europa programmes have been an absolute joy.
The poster has been, it'll be absolutely fantastic. I mean, you've probably seen that. I mean, people are getting these framed, and they've got all three of them all together at the moment, and it looks just great, brilliant.
But yeah, little things, and I think we sat down and thought about it. Obviously, it's not as much advertising in the Europa programs as well. So some of the content that's in there has been incredible, and obviously real collector's items. Even if we do continue to qualify for Europe season after season, which is obviously the aim, these are the first ones. So yeah, real collector's items in that respect, and we've had some really positive feedback on those. And like I say, Luke's done a brilliant job. He's been with us for over 10 years
at least.
Yeah, over 10 years. And I knew Luke from, he was working at Shoot and Match magazine back in the day and what have you. And I obviously came in and done the program and done a brilliant job with it. And we're really proud of what gets put out for every home game. And it's not easy. I used to do that job. I know how difficult it is. It's a lot of hard work, whether you're writing it, writing the copy, editing the copy, pulling it all together, giving it a bit of flow through the issue, overseeing, you know, like the design, the layout. But yeah, I think he does a sterling job with it. In fact, just before I came on this call, I was looking at proofs for Sundays.
Right, Paul, right at the top of the show, we talked about the journey and your time with the club so far and the parallels. And for me, you gave a little bit of a politician's answer because you talked about the journey of the club and all the fans. But what I really wanted was your personal odyssey. From kid on the terraces to you know, having the talent to be able to sort of put into words quite nicely and succinctly the things that we were all feeling, to the role that you've got now. So, you know, given the growth of both the club and your role, now you've talked about the growth of the club, but tell us what it's been like for you personally, both on the pitch, off the pitch, as a fan, and as the person who runs the media comms.
It's been incredible, really. I would say I've been incredibly lucky. I work with some incredible people, be they colleagues, managers, players, chairman. Yeah, been absolutely incredible from the get-go. I mean, going in, Brian Horton is a friend who was the first manager when I first started working at the club. If I go to Manchester, we normally will try and hook up and at least have a coffee or a bit of dinner if he comes down here. You know, and yeah, so many of those relationships with people who've been integral to the football club. But I think we were lucky in the mid-90s when, you know, I met some incredible people. Paul Samra, John Bain, Ian Hart, yourselves, you know, lifelong friendships were forged. The football was terrible. The club was on its knees. But what a time to be an Albion fan, because you made friends for life who, you know, most Monday nights, me and Dad Tester sit down and watch Monday night football together and share a bottle of wine. You know, we're always talking about the Albion. But so, you know, so much of that. And then to be lucky enough to see what we see. I'm the same as you guys. I might not be sat up in West Upper with you lot, but I'm the same as you. I'm sat there willing the team to win, desperate for the team to win. It's different as well because it's people you go to work with every day that are out there on the pitch. And, you know, they're an incredible group of players. Their players are ordinary people. They're like you or us. They like to do the things away from football that we like to do. You know, so seeing that, I've seen some amazing, amazing things happen. People's lives change. You know, even watching young Jack Hinchelwood, I find that, I love that, you know, seeing him out on the pitch. And I think, I saw his old man make his debut at the teenager away at Burnley in 2003, was it? 2000?
Yeah, it was under Martin.
22 years ago. You know, we had Martin Hinchelwood in the other week on the podcast. And I just love chatting with Martin about those old times. And, yeah, you know, those sort of people, were, again, they're in the fabric, the DNA, the history of this football club, this great football club. You know, the pride that Martin and the family must have had that night when Jack makes his debut or scores the winner against Brentford or scores against Palace. You know, it's incredible. You know, and then you see the team winning games like they did at Arsenal last year. I mean, there was one moment me and Steve Gibbon looked at each other when we scored the fourth against Man United in that game a couple of seasons ago under Graham. Just started laughing. And we're just laughing at one another because it was like, this is ridiculous. This shouldn't happen. But it did happen. And, you know, it was like an incredible moment. And I think for a lot of the older fans that were maybe there in 83, I was only five. I vaguely remember it, so not the same. I think there was a real moment of sort of closure on that moment when we put four past them for that night, that Thursday night back in 1983. So I'd just been incredibly lucky.
Dull, has it?
No, and it isn't. I love going to work. I love walking into the training ground every morning or the stadium, wherever it might be.
Yeah.
You know, being lucky enough to be in that environment. And don't get me wrong, it's like any job. There are days where you have crap days at work. Don't get me wrong. Or you have a day where you don't quite fancy going in or whatever. It's the same with any job in that respect. But overall, I've been incredibly privileged that the club have put on with me.
Yeah. They still haven't got you to do the boot room quiz, though, Paul.
No,
You'd smash it.
I couldn't possibly.
You against Gibbo, come on.
Any of our first team squad in that way, shape, or form. No way. But I mean, by the way, what isn't that brilliant? That's us. That's Brian that we've got Bud doing that. And he's so natural. He's brilliant. He's great with the players. The bond and the relationship he has with the players and that he's formed and what have you is great. And I've got a huge amount of time for, there's a lot of good people at that football club, like Buzz, and so on. They are a huge, huge reason in why we are successful. We touched on it earlier and that is a lot of the reason why, you know, the people that have been recruited and are trusted to get on and do the job. That's a big part of success.
I think
ultimately, listen, let's not, I'm doing the players a huge disservice, by the way. The players are ultimately, they're the ones that step out there. They're the most important people at this football club. The 25 that are in that squad and what they've given us over the last, throughout my time at this football club, but certainly in the last 18 months, and certainly in the time we've been in the Premier League, I think, that's why fans, when you 4-0 down away at Luton, stay in the ground to clatter you off at the end.
Absolutely. And there's going to be a squad going out to Rome on Thursday night, and we're going to be 100% behind them, hoping we can bring them back to the Amex and get through to the quarterfinal.
I think we've got a great chance. Fingers crossed.
That'd be with Pedro, though, Paul.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. But I think we've got a great chance with the fans behind us. You just don't know. We've got a really good chance. I don't think we should fear anybody in that competition.
No.
I'm looking forward to both legs. It should be a top night.
It's going to be amazing. And that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you so much to Paul Campbell for joining us here on the Albion Roar with Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham, and we are on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB, and of course on the podcast in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. See you then. Bye.